Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, the making of a masterful chef. Amy Thielen is out with a memoir that takes us along on her adventures. From her mother's kitchen in northern Minnesota to the high-stakes ballet of the dinner rush in New York restaurants and back to family and friends and food, inspired by all of those experiences. In reading her story, I wondered if you can taste a chef's memory and internal imagination and how it influences the food that they make. And so that's what I thought would make a pretty interesting conversation for the roundtable. And I thought it would be fun if we'd hear from you on social media. Is there a food or a special dish that exemplifies how and where you grew up in this country or somewhere else? Tell me about that dish on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I. NPR. Amy Thielen is a chef and a writer. Her new memoir is titled Give a Girl a Knife. Best title ever. Love it.
Thank
Welcome.
You.
Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Tommy Beavis is a chef and co-owner of Pimento Kitchen. Welcome. Really good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
And Ann Kim is with us. She's a chef and an owner of Pizzeria Lola. Seems that we never do a roundtable about food without you, Ann. And I am so grateful that you're willing to come back and chat with me.
Well,
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amy, more than the style and the tools and the ideas that your mother and your grandmother passed on to you, you know, I want to know about how growing up in northern Minnesota, well, I guess, shaped your imagination, and then how that infuses your food.
Well, I mean, they also passed on their OCD cleaning habits, which
okay,
really
more than the tools, more than that.
Well, yeah, later on. But no, I think what's interesting about growing up in Park Rapids, honestly, is that it is, when you drive in, it's, you meet this potato factory, and it's the largest producer of French fries in North America, I believe, or at least in the U.S. And so sometimes it's kind of that, you know, fast food nation thing. But there was a real divide between that and what I experienced at home.
How
and
so?
So my mom was a really great cook. And, you know, we were very, we revered our family food and everything that she made. So, you know, I would walk in the house and it's like this potpourri of pork, you know, lots of German-American food. And it's very strong smelling and really delicious, but all day long, you know. So she generally was always cooking something, so that sound and that, I mean, the smell, the sound, it was just a huge part of our life. I mean, she lived to go to the grocery store and make dinner. She was a stay-at-home mom of three and did a lot of hockey running too, but did a lot of cooking. So I think that for me, it really is that inside-outside, and that's kind of when I started seeing that you could have really different things in one place, that it could be very varied. And really this book is about that, about moving in between worlds.
Right. So the reason I ask the question like that is something that you say, and this is something I'm going to ask Ann and Tommy about too. You say, I wanted to cook like my Midwestern great grandma had, with the feeling of scantness at my back. Mm. Well, what is that?
Right. So I also grew up with, you know, no holds barred. We had everything we ever wanted for food. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, there was, we're not going hungry. So I didn't have a feeling of scantness whatsoever. It was super abundant. Mm-hmm. But when I got out of college and we were living, Aaron and I were living in his house in the woods, and we're kind of playing pioneer, basically. no power, no running water. And I was obsessed with the, you know, two generations previous and their cooking and how they made do. And that scrappiness, and I did want to feel that. Like I also wrote, you know, I was cooking and discovering things that my childhood had lacked, which was baby greens and deprivation. So I had never really felt that, and I feel like it's really necessary for cooking to feel some of that, to feel a little bit of scarceness, because it makes everything more precious.
Tommy, that's such a powerful idea to me, because it flips things around a bit. I think we're immersed in the idea of abundance, That's what we want.
Absolutely.
More and more. I like the fact that Amy wanted to go back to. So what does that say to you?
Interestingly enough, coming from Jamaica, where we don't have the plethora of options as Americans have, I'm like, yeah, I kind of know what you're talking about there. But what's interesting is growing up in Kingston in particular, we had the best the island had to offer right there at our fingertips at the local Coronation Market. So you can, every Saturday morning, go down there and get the freshest produce from all over the island. And that's where other vendors from different parts of the island would come to purchase their items as well, and then take it to the tourist resorts or take it to the countryside. And so it was great to be in the cultural, spiritual, and food mecca of Jamaica, to where I could literally just walk by and be able to get the freshest of mangoes, the freshest of yams, the freshest of potatoes. And, you know, and
see, that's a different kind of abundance, though,
right,
isn't it? Maybe different than the one and the we that how we would define that today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting what Amy said about having that scarcity make you appreciate things more. We immigrated to this country in the 70s, and back then there wasn't, you couldn't just go to the grocery store or the market and find ingredients that my grandmother and my mother grew up with in Korea, or even the kinds of produce at the grocery store. So it was, my grandmother and my mother grew gardens. It was necessity, right? You couldn't buy it, so you had to produce it. We couldn't buy kimchi, so we made it. We couldn't buy doenjang, so my grandmother fermented it. And so it's what they say, necessity is the mother of all things and invention. And for us, we didn't grow up with a lot, and so we had to make it. And for me, in my house, growing up with that idea of creating from scratch because we had to do it. And now it's kind of something where it's like, wow, we're going back to that.
Right. I mean, hasn't as food availability and food trends have changed, isn't there a new appreciation for hungering for the stuff that isn't just at your fingertips? And I don't mean in complexity, really actually more in simplicity. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, really, the garden is what taught me this, you know, that limitations is what really makes creativity work.
Right.
You know, because...
See, you would think it would be the opposite,
no,
though. That's what's
not
so interesting about this idea.
Yeah, because you could say, oh, I can do anything.
Right.
I can do anything. Well, you have no narrowing, you know. You need to have some blinders on and some limitations. And if you're cooking out of the garden, as I did in my early 20s, I learned that, you know, that this was precious and I had to deal with these beans today. I couldn't wait. And, you know, I didn't have very many, so I had to do this. Or I had, you know, 2 bushel baskets, so I had to make something out of it. But it caused it. They moved me, you know, and not the other way around. And really, cooking's beautiful when your ingredients are telling you what to make.
Absolutely. And I it's so funny because you're talking about that. My grandmother, Babalu, would say, turn your hand, make fashion. So
what does that mean?
It's like basically going back to the necessity being the mother of all invention.
Yeah.
When you have, for example, you're making rice and beans, and if you don't have kidney beans, but you have some pigeon peas, mm-hmm. you figure out how to make that work. So you turn your hand and make fashion with it.
Yeah, turn your hand and make fashion.
I like that.
Exactly. So no matter what you have, you can create an amazing meal from it. And that's why I love even like the show Chopped, because it's like you have 5 random ingredients that you weren't even planning for. And the challenge is for you to make an amazing dish out of it, you know.
Yeah.
And so that scarcity that you're talking about, it really does push one's creativity in the kitchen to where you're not necessarily tied to the specific recipe, but you can then be creative and smoked turkey instead of ham hock.
Flip side, the surplus, and like what do people make in Jamaica when all the mangoes come on at one time?
That's
you
right.
Know?
You make mango nectar, mango jelly, mango jam.
Exactly. You preserve, you ferment.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like... in November, when we were younger, we would take all this cabbage and we would ferment it. We didn't have a bowl big enough. We used our kiddie pool, basically,
wow.
to brine
oh my
cabbage.
God. This is a good image.
And it was
I
a ritual. That. We were in our basement laundry room. We were all doing the kimchi squat. And if you're Korean, you know what this
squat.
Means. And we're all taking turns, you know, pasting... hundreds of pounds of Napa cabbage to get us through the winter, you know. And what... Amy was talking about in terms of simplicity. Simplicity isn't easy. You can't hide. You know, you have a list of maybe 5 ingredients. I mean,
it has to be spot on because you can taste everything. You understand the thought and intention behind each ingredient, where if you have a multitude of ingredients and techniques, you can often hide around different things or you can't pinpoint what you're tasting. It just tastes like an amalgam of things. But with simplicity, everything needs to shine. And that, I think, is where the true art comes in.
I worked for a bunch of different chefs and they had different styles, but it was tweezer food often. And some of the chefs I worked for toward the end.
Meaning, well, what is that?
Tweezer food, meaning you plate it with the tweezers. You know, you have to have the really good raw materials or it doesn't work.
It's a balance. Yeah,
go ahead, Anne.
I mean, I think there are amazing chefs that are doing amazing work with technique that I wouldn't even know where to begin. But I do think what they do have behind that is this sense of taste memory. I mean, we talk about Amy's book and the things that really, I read her book and I thought it was amazing and it really resonated with me because a lot of what she goes back to is taste memory. You know, her first taste of a fresh pea or, you know, potatoes and how she takes that and translates that into her fine dining cooking experience. And some of the chefs that she was inspired by who would go back to their sort of Eastern European roots, that they were creating this amazing puree or a composed dish, but it always came back to sort of this muscle memory of how they cooked. They didn't use recipes. It was about how they were watching their grandmothers or their mothers before them, and it was just in their body and how they tasted and how they remembered how this needed acid or this needed sugar or this needed salt. And I don't think that's something that comes from technique. I think that comes from something that's deeper.
So, Tommy, do you feel like if I didn't know where you were from and I encountered you and your cooking for the first time in your restaurant, I could have a sense of tasting your food, what your taste memory is? Would I know that?
With Jamaican food, it's kind of complex because naturally you have the jerks that we're famous for, but you also have the curries and the stews. So coming into Pimento Jamaican Kitchen for the first time, and if you order the curry, you might be confused. You're like, but this isn't Thai curry. You know, because it's treated differently. And it was basically more so the influence of the Indians coming to Jamaica that influenced our curries.
So that's going to make it a little more complicated than really understanding what your own taste memory is about.
Absolutely right. And then when you think of it, Jamaicans are heavy on rice, heavy on coconut milk. But when you combine some of those tropical flavors, naturally one can be taken back to the island simply by tasting some of these items. And if you're familiar with the food from being on the beach, you definitely want to have that experience relived time and time again. And so that muscle memory has to be there because people's muscle memories are there and they're now coming to expect that same experience.
So, Anne, you with mixing pizza and Korean food, I mean, you're kind of in the place that Tommy's in too. You're trying to bring in, an internal taste memory and mix that with a food from a different part of the world.
I think if you eat my food, particularly at Young Joni, is kind of the culmination of sort of my taste memory. And people think it's odd. Well, you're Korean. You're not Italian. You're making wood-fired pizzas. But now you're also throwing in kimchi as a side and roasted, Japanese sweet potatoes and Korean barbecue. So how does this make sense? It makes perfect sense to me. That's how I grew up. Growing up in this country, like I alluded to earlier, we had to create and make things that we couldn't purchase. But of the things we could purchase, and growing up in Apple Valley, Minnesota, which was at the time not as diverse as it is now, I grew up with kids eating bologna sandwiches and pizza as a special Friday cafeteria food. And so for me, it was about a mixing of what we could get in this country of abundance and the things that we would make. And so in many sense, my taste buds are a little, all over the board, a little schizophrenic, but that's how I grew up. And so to me, I was just pulling from different cultures and how I grew up and creating a new flavor, a flavor of growing up here in America, and creating what tasted good to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't unheard of to see us with a bowl of rice and a stew and a bunch of marinated banchan, which means side dishes, and a bucket of KFC and ketchup.
Nice.
I mean, that is what I was eating.
The ketchup was the weird part.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable inspired by Amy Thielen's new book, Give a Girl a Knife. It's a memoir about her establishing her own taste memories and her experience of growing up in northern Minnesota and how that traveled with her out to New York to work in some very fine restaurant kitchens there and then to come back to the food and the family and how that influences the way she thinks about food back here in Minnesota. Her memoir called Give a Girl a Knife. Tommy Beavis is with us. He's a chef and co-owner of Pimento Kitchen. And Ann Kim is a chef and owner of Pizzeria Lola. And I'm asking you, as you listen in here, if there's a food or a special dish that really exemplifies how and where you grew up in this country or anywhere else, tell me about that dish on Twitter. You might even throw in a few ingredients in the recipe. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. So I think, Amy, food says more about a family than just this is what we like and, you know, this is what we can afford and this is who we are. I think it also says something about values and relationships.
One thing I realized once I left and when I came back is our food defined us. And in a really big way. And that doesn't happen for every family.
And not in a, we liked these dishes on Sunday afternoon. In a broader way.
In a Catholic way, probably.
Okay. Right? How so?
Because we kind of worship the idols. And the idols were bacon and butter and fermented dill pickles. I mean, really, honestly. And, you know, they were also very good Catholics. My grandmother always had, you know, the little holy water thing outside the doors, you know, and she did all of that stuff. But, you know, yeah, I think we worshipped the food. And my grandmother had this way of, like, making everything just sound so exciting. Just like, you know, fried bologna was just the best thing you could ever even imagine. Yeah. And it was good bologna. It was, like, homemade. My uncle makes it, blah, blah. But, like, yeah, she had a way of just, like, making everything from pickle sandwiches to, you know, just her cucumbers sliced with vinegar and black pepper just sound like food of the royals.
How would you describe that in your family, Tommy? So when did you grew up in Kingston in Jamaica. When did you come here?
I moved to the U.S. in 99 for undergrad, but I lived in Miami and Tampa, Washington, D.C., then eventually made it out here to Minnesota.
Wow, okay.
And it's so funny because growing up, though, in Kingston, we, like my family, had our own fishing boat, so we'd actually get the freshest of snapper fish. Like, you're talking a 10-pound snapper that you just slice and dice and fry and, you know, and then you can have, like, the best of lobster and octopus and shark, you name it. We were able to experiment with it. And I think that's what made me fall in love with food, recognizing the, for lack of a better term in this case, abundance of what we could experiment with, you know, and how we could experiment. And my grandmother was not afraid to try new techniques, even though she's an old school chef, you know, when she...
Which means what?
Ooh, very good question. An old school chef.
She was a chef.
Well, no. She actually was a businesswoman who ran her own companies, whether it's clothing or food or shoes, for example, is one of the big things that she was selling at the time. But yet still, when she came home, we were all throwing down in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what time you get home, it's like, all right, let's do this. And it was a family get together time, you know, and if we're even using a coal stove, one person will be responsible for starting the coal stove, even though we had a guest.
A coal stove
is basically, it's basically a metal round cylindrical stove, and you use charcoal, and that really amplifies the flavors of whatever you're cooking. And you can even turn an old car rim, the wheel, into a coal stove just with coal. And
so she preferred the coal stove, it sounds like, to
absolutely
anything else that she could have been cooking on?
Absolutely. First of all, it's very painful to maintain. But from a flavor standpoint, she knew how to control the temperatures on a coal stove.
Wow.
And then, I don't know, maybe it's the dust from the coal getting into the food or something, but the food just tastes so different.
Yeah. Well, it's a more radiant heat, like those old, you know, those old farmhouse wood stoves.
Absolutely.
It's a hotter heat. It's like when you go into a house that has a wood stove, mm-hmm. you know you can feel yeah. it, and that's what it's doing to your food.
You can't
too,
replicate
think.
That idea of rusticness. And I think with Young Joni, we cook everything on the line by wood fire, and we have three different places where we cook it, 2 wood-fired ovens and a 7-foot wood fire grill. And I think there is this sense of trying to go back to that, that you can't replicate out of sous vide a piece of meat. It really is some of those imperfections, a little bit of the char in corners where you wouldn't expect it, but that's where the real flavor comes from. And what Amy said about heat, certain kinds of heat, dry heat, radiant heat, you cannot get that in other sources, you know, from flame or from the consistent heat of coals. And I think for me, that's the beauty of it, going back to sort of this primitive, scarce way of cooking. And we've lost touch with some of that, with all these technological advancements that we've made. And I love it.
I'm so glad, too. I'm so glad that cooking is moving in that direction. I mean, restaurants and chefs and things like that.
It's really notable to hear you talk about imperfections, right, as being actually being a quality that you want to embrace. Because, I mean, from the outside looking in and all these food shows, and you mentioned, what was it, Chopped?
Yes.
Yeah, the show. It just seems like more and more push towards, you know, beauty and perfection in food.
Consistency.
Yes, consistency. That's right. And what I hear you guys saying is it's the imperfection where it shines.
Yeah, and we're not saying produce
different
bad, imperfect, you know, product and send out burnt, dry pieces of fish. But I think what we're trying to say here is that it goes back. Imperfection, I think we all grew up with that sense of grandmother's pasta salad wasn't quite perfect, but there was something in that that till this day you can't quite replicate. There was something that she used to do that just made her pasta salad with Spam in it just so much better than yours.
Okay, is it really something she used to do, or is it was her? And
I think, you know, when you asked about family and what food meant to me, when I think about my family, it's all about food. That's how that's how my mother showed love. That's how my grandmother showed love. It was something that brought them great joy. I have connections, emotional connections to my upbringing based on food-related things. You know, my mother worked a graveyard shift doing housekeeping, and there was a winter storm in when I was growing up. And when you're smaller, you always feel like those winter storms are bigger. And she was
always bigger though.
Oh, they were. I think so. And colder. So my mother was always home though to make dinner, and she wasn't. And I was extremely worried and scared. And she finally, you know, this is pre cell phone time. And so my grandmother said, start dinner. Get dinner going. And I still remember this, sauteing pork and onions and kimchi.
Nice.
And it was a really simple dish, but a dish that I just love. And I couldn't focus on that. I was worried about my mother. I burned the pork. And my mother came in, and she was stressed and worried and had a junky car. And she came home, and we were just so overjoyed to see her. But the first thing she did was she yelled at me for burning the pork, you know, and it was just that emotional connection to just being everything, you know, worry and joy and love and fear. And it's all wrapped up in food memory for me.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation with three chefs about the making of a masterful chef, the food memories that go into that, the sense of family, the development of I guess of kind of that internal landscape around food, and how where you grew up and how you grew up really ends up getting infused into the food. It's inspired by Amy Thielen's new memoir called Give a Girl a Knife. We'll get a look at the latest news, and we'll come back and continue our conversation.
Morning, I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. President Trump tweeted about the sputtering Senate health care bill this morning. Trump said if Republican senators are unable to pass what they are working on now, they should immediately repeal and then replace at a later date. A Senate vote on health care reform has been delayed until after the Independence Day break. As authorities enforce a trimmed-down version of President Trump's travel ban, advocates for immigrants are preparing for new court challenges. People from the six affected countries will now have to prove a close family relationship with someone in the U.S. or an existing relationship with an entity like a school or a business. Critics say the ban is arbitrary and restrictive. A Customs and Border Protection spokesman says the agency expects business as usual at entry points. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is back at the White House for his second day of meetings with President Trump. Moon arrived at the White House for an Oval Office meeting with Trump this morning. The two leaders dined together last night, and Trump said they discussed security issues involving North Korea and trade. Beijing has strongly protested a U.S. plan to sell $1.4 billion worth of arms to Taiwan, and it's demanding the deal be canceled. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Liu Kang says Washington should immediately stop the sale to avoid harming relations with Beijing. And Kentucky's only maximum security prison is on lockdown after inmates attacked eight workers. Authorities say 16 inmates attacked the workers yesterday near a canteen line in the yard of the Kentucky State Penitentiary. The injured workers included officers, sergeants, lieutenants, and a captain, and all were treated for non-life-threatening injuries. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:32.
Hey, it's John Moe. Be sure to check out my podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression. It's always honest, sometimes very moving, and sometimes pretty funny. And it's a Webby Award winner for Best Comedy Podcast. Find it wherever you find your podcasts.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11, we'll call down to Cuba to catch up with the Minnesota Youth Symphonies and the high school students who are there this week. We're also looking back on 40 years since the famous Glenn Sheen murders in Duluth. All of that at 11.
Programming supported by Atomic Data, a Microsoft partner providing SQL 2016 databases in the Atomic Cloud. Microsoft SQL has been verified by Nest as the least vulnerable database for 6 years. More about secure cloud databases at atomicdata.com/SQL. Programming supported by John Reamer & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated in Minnesota, and pleased to sponsor the Among the Wild film project, showcasing wilderness adventures in Minnesota. Be inspired. JohnReamer.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation of how I'm thinking about it as kind of the making of a masterful chef inspired by a new memoir that Amy Thielen has out. We've asked Amy to join us. Tommy Beavis is with us. He's the chef and co-owner at Pimento Kitchen. And Ann Kim is here, chef and owner of Pizzeria Lola. So, Tommy, in the break there, you had a suggestion, which I think is interesting, this idea of how you turn this connection and interest with food into something that helps you fulfill ambition.
Absolutely.
And desire. So let's turn the question back on you first. How did that happen?
No, my background is in political science and economics.
What?
Exactly. So got recruited out of Washington, D.C. To join a corporation here in the community relations space. But during getting my MBA, I knew that I was hungry and passionate about business on its own. And then at the same token, I was extremely passionate about food. I'd race home from a long day to go fire up the grill and start cooking. That's how I relaxed. Mm-hmm. And then lo and behold, when the opportunity presented itself to start Pimento Jamaican Kitchen using my grandmother's recipes, I naturally jumped on it, which fortunately for me, it was the Food Network that came calling. But we started off with testing it slowly at street events like the Uptown Art Fair with my grill from my backyard and a $100 tent from Target, literally. And that's how we got started. But it was more so, I think the calling for food was always there. And I remember as a child, like I was 12, my grandmother busted me cooking. And she literally kicked me out of the kitchen. I was like, no, cooking is for girls.
Oh.
Right. Mm. And then 2 years later, she's like, when I did not give up, she's like, clearly this dude knows something. And then she took me under her wing. And then within no time at all, I was cooking the Sunday dinners. you know, and wow. That's a big deal.
Because you're like talking about 14 or 15.
Absolutely. So you're talking about 3-4 meats on a Sunday. You know,
dang.
Yeah, absolutely. And plethora of sides.
Yeah, and I like your Sunday dinners.
Oh, my goodness. It's a massive spread, and anybody from the community would pop in, and wow. We'd be able to just enjoy it. And so that was such a part of me that I just couldn't shake it.
It wasn't going to be denied, basically,
yeah.
Even though you went into corporate America.
Yes. Yeah, wow. And it was right there still calling me every single day.
Anne, how about you?
Well, in many ways, it started from the same passion. When I wasn't working, I was cooking. And I had sort of a roundabout path. I thought about law school. I was an actor for 8 years of my life. I mean, Amy and I know each other from way back when in mm-hmm. high school through mutual sort of nerdy speech
we were
debate
kind of
the and thespian,
thespian
nerds.
Squad.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that creative edge for sure. But yeah, and so... when I was acting, and by no means was that lucrative, but when I wasn't acting and working, I was always cooking. To me, again, that's how I showed appreciation for my friends and my family, and it brought me tremendous amount of joy to see people eating and saying, this is amazing, and it was always a part of my blood. I think all three of us, it's ingrained in our blood in our skin. I mean, it's Amy said pork potpourri.
I mean,
that's
that.
Yeah, they
yeah.
should sell that.
They should.
But that it's always been a part of me. And I think when I finally got to the point where the acting wasn't really fulfilling me, I thought, well, what is it that I really love to do? And how could I turn that into something that I could actually make a livelihood of? And I think you really do. In order to be very successful, whatever path you go to, you have to truly love it. And with a lot of, sweat equity and hard work, I was able to turn that love for cooking and food and making people happy into a profession.
You know, you've made me wonder if I had grown up in a family of good cooks, which I didn't, would I be? I'm a terrible cook. And
come on, Carrie.
Is it something missing from my personality?
No. I mean, you just can learn all this stuff. You can learn it.
Oh, I think you can learn to be competent as a cook. And, you know, I choose not to. What I'm not sure you can learn is just that true core.
The heart.
Creativeness, mm-hmm. creativity in the heart that you bring to it. Yeah. I mean, that's what you guys are kind of exemplifying here.
And there's a lot to learn about cooking. There are a lot of mistakes to be made before you start making
but it's more.
Successes.
Yeah.
But
it's
it is more. It's deeper than that, though. It is. It's a soulful thing. Mm-hmm. And you watch somebody like your mom or your grandma or somebody in your family, you watch them transmit an emotion through their food.
That's it.
And
yes.
you don't necessarily cerebrally catch that.
Exactly.
But like deep down, you get the message. And then you want, when you get older, you want to do that too.
Right.
And I think that's it. I mean, for me, cooking has always been a procrastination from writing. That's
really?
How it began. Yeah, I was in college at McAllister and... Afterward, my husband, you know, my boyfriend, then we moved up to his house in the woods and, we didn't have any bills. So we were kind of living a little hippie, simple life. And I didn't have a job and I was going to write something, write something. And I would just sit there and like nothing. And I'm like, oh, this is horrible. Like, I have nothing to write about. And I'm so glad I made that decision that I hadn't really lived enough or done enough to actually write. And it lifted, and then I was just, like, free to pursue my total all-consuming passion, which was just reading cookbooks and gardening and cooking.
Which would lead you back to writing, as it was
eventually.
Meant to.
And,
right?
And I remember,
full circle.
Yeah. I mean, I started working in a diner on Main Street in Park Rapids, and that's kind of a funny chapter in the book. A lot of good characters there. But and then, you know, New York, and then finally back. But when I was, you know, in the kind of the depths of struggling with writing this memoir, there was a moment where... I was, grousing about it to Aaron and complaining. He's just like, this is what you wanted, right? And I'm like, no, these are the two things colliding.
Yeah.
This is like,
the
you know...
two hardest things, right?
Yeah. And I'm like, I can't use one to procrastinate against the other one. It's like, ah. So
what were
I met myself.
What were you thinking about when it comes to risk and technique?
I was thinking about how, I like what you guys were both saying about cooking on coal and cooking over wood and how, and what I like about that kind of cooking too. I cook over a wood fire, like a grill that Aaron built. That's really cool. We cook over wood. And there is an element of risk to it. And that's what makes it great because, mm-hmm. you know, you're taking something to, you want smokiness to be infused with it. And that's kind of it's a soulful flavor just mm-hmm. On its own naturally. But when you take something to the brink of burnt, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but you don't go there, you know, that's the risk. You're taking risk. And I really feel like any cooking life has an element of risk to it because it is a risky career.
And that is something you can't teach.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Going back to the heart.
You can teach recipes, you can teach technique, but you can't teach how to be inspired and take risks and chances and throw things to the wind and see what turns out on the other side. Mm-hmm. And I think the most challenging thing for me in this industry is how to teach young cooks not about replicating the recipe or doing, you know, the repetition of it, but really understanding when, you know, something comes in and throws you for a loop. For instance, dough. Dough is all about time and temperature. And living in Minnesota, you have to adjust the way you deal with the dough, the way you proof it, the amount of hydration it gets. The humidity can completely blow your dough, and the amount of heat and how that reacts. And you can't necessarily teach that with a recipe. You have to learn that from feeling it, from smelling it, from tasting it, and just doing it over and over again until you become an expert, till you feel it in your soul. It's the same thing with like fermentation and kimchi. I realized one day, I said, why aren't these guys getting the kimchi? It's not that hard. And what I realized, they were just going by what I had said in the winter about 7-day fermentation. And they followed that throughout the season. But in the summer, no, it's 4 days. Sometimes it's 3. Sometimes it's 3.5. But they never grew up eating kimchi. They didn't understand that at some point the sourness is too puckery sour. And sometimes it's just enough. And so that is something that you have to just get through mm-hmm. doing and understanding
okay.
on another level.
Oh, go ahead.
This is a great place, though, for I was watching a talk by Jacques Pepin, the great chef, mm-hmm. About understanding technique to the point where you can forget it.
Just like if you're a painter, you know, you work 2 or 3 years in a studio and you learn how to, the law of perspective, and you learn how to mix yellow and blue to do green. And you know you can do that with your thumb or with a spatula and all that. So you kind of learn the trick of the trade, meaning that after 3 years you can stand outside and you can do one painting after another. Does that make you a great artist? No, you're a good technician. That's what you are. Well, in the kitchen, likewise, you know, you have to become a good technician. And I'm sure a surgeon, as well as a mason, first have to become good technician before they move forward.
And does that, I mean, I think that really fits what you were saying about teaching kimchi.
I mean, I did a lot of research prior to opening up Pizzeria Lola on my own. Back then, there were no books on pizza. It was really, I read a lot of artisan bread baking books about the technique of great artisan bread. And then I did go to pizza school. There is a school that teaches you how to make pizza. And did a lot of research and figuring out how to create the best bread, which is essentially great pizza. Mm-hmm. And then from there, what I think kind of differentiated my direction to maybe some others is that then you take that and you turn it into something that you own, that's yours, you know, something new. And I think I love that quote by Jacques Pepin about understanding techniques of color, you know, that you can make, you can learn how to paint, but then what creates an artist? It's very different.
Yeah. But not all that different in the chef world.
Right. I think the technique is very important. And I can harken back to when I'd share my recipes with friends. And, you know, they'd go home and try to make the rice and beans. And I'm like, I'm telling you exactly what I do. And they just could never get it right. Yeah. And I think it's just that spirit of it. It's just that experience knowing that, yeah, even the water in St. Louis Park might taste different than the water in Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah.
So you figure
yep.
out how to
totally.
Compensate for
Absolutely.
It. And so it's that risk factor and it's that freedom to, or the understanding of how to best manage that risk that helps you figure out how to to sort of like correct flavors and get and fine tune it mm-hmm. The way your grandmother would know how to do mm-hmm. you know, so the technical side of it is important, but it's that fine tuning that mm-hmm. it just can't be taught
from good to great.
Yeah,
right,
you know,
good
I mean,
to great, exactly.
That's exactly where I was at that point after 7 years of line cooking in New York City, where I had amassed a lot of techniques, like all these different chefs, and they cook differently. And that was really part of the reason I went home, is because I realized that for me to become my own chef, and like you say, you know, Anne, about bringing something unique, you know, you're making your own pizza that tastes like your pizza. And for me to be able to make my own cuisine, even though I wasn't starting a restaurant, but just like personally, like as a personal quest, as a chef, as, you know, feeling like that's my discipline, right? I wanted to go home and explore the materials of my home and then take the techniques that I had learned and see what I could do. Because I realized, I'm like, you know, I've been to a lot of great restaurants and I had eaten a lot of food that was very technically good, but not necessarily soulful and not connected to anything. And it wasn't connected to their
taste. How do you taste the difference of that, Amy?
Well, I just feel like there's something like in the food that is connected to a sense memory or a taste memory for a chef. Somehow you can taste it. Somehow you can feel that this is special. Like David Boulay, he's got, you know, this sauce called Ocean Herbal, and it's made with a bunch of herb purees and a clam juice, fresh clam juice base, and a bunch of pulps that he thickens it with. And they were, he would always tell the story about how, you know, his grandmother would rake all the fall vegetables into a big pile, and they would put them in the fire. And then, you know, half a day later, they would unwrap them. It'd be this like very soft pulp of beet, of potato, of onion, of fennel, of all the garden stuff. And so he had all those in the sauce, and it was like, that's something special because it is definitely linked. And, you know, Shea Galante, like just like the Italian American stuff. And, you know, you can see it. And when you're really deep into cooking and you're starting to, you're absorbing all these other people's lives and chefs,
right?
You can see which dishes are most powerful are the ones that they also have stories to tell about them.
And soulful, I think, goes beyond just the taste of the food. I think being in the restaurant industry now, I really realize that soul is about the total experience. It's about the people that are cooking it and how they come out, and if they recognize you, that they hug you and they treat you like family. And that's essentially what I'm trying to get back to, is that feeling of love. And I want people to walk into my restaurants and feel like the minute they walk in, they smell what they're going to experience. I want my restaurants to give you a big hug, you know, just like that sense of, I don't want to leave, that this is familiar. It's unfamiliar, but it's familiar. And to me, that's hospitality. And I think really great hospitality is soul. I think that's what it is. And I think there's really polished hospitality and ways where it's like, oh yeah, this is, you know, like TGI Fridays. They tell you this is what you say and, you know, have a whatever day. And that's not authentic. It's not genuine. Right. It's just sort of, here's a checklist of what it's you corporate. Need to do. Soul is so much more. It's personal.
Absolutely. And I think that's the point of it. When you talk about soul, it takes you back to home. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at Pimento, we say welcome home when you come in.
I love
you
that.
Know? And it's the informality of welcoming you home is what makes it authentic. And then the other thing about the flavor, too, that sort of was touched on is, I think it's the little imperfections that differentiate the authentic flavors of, say, a Jamaican or cultural food versus the techniques that makes it so perfect. Mm-hmm. So the right amount of caramelization on a right amount of burnt on an oxtail is how you know the difference between an authentic Jamaican restaurant and, you know, others who are just like, yeah, I saw that on a recipe.
Okay, so Tommy, tell me how you talk to the people that work in your kitchen about that idea of taking some risks and not being perfect, and that is where the heart of the food. What do you say to them about that?
Interesting enough, so a lot of our cooks are local Minnesotans, Bear Lake representing. And so one of the first things that we do is we try to impress upon them the stories behind the flavors, the stories behind the restaurant, the stories behind my grandmother's cooking, because we're literally using my grandmother's Dutch oven in the kitchen, you know. So if you're cooking with Baby Lou's Dutch oven, you treat it with respect. You know?
What's her name?
Baby Lou.
Ooh, nice. Know, right? Cool? How can you not love her?
And so one of the very first things we did with our very first chef was brought them to Jamaica. Brought them to the local market.
Oh, awesome.
So you can see the difference between a habanero pepper and a Scotch bonnet pepper. You can taste the difference between the pimento that you get in Jamaica and the imported type of stuff. You know, you can smell, you can, you know, and so bringing that experience, bringing them to that experience, help them better understand the story and the spirit behind the food. But with those who you can't afford to take to Jamaica every single week, what you do is you have to take time with them and help them understand the technique. But at the same time, you have to be doing it with through the eyes of a storyteller. You know, so like, yeah, I remember when my grandmother would flip the fish this way, you know, what she would tell me about the reason why you flip it that way, why you start on this side of the meat versus that side of meat, you know, that type of thing. And so with that, hopefully they can feel her spirit, bring her spirit alive when cooking her food.
Do you all realize how often you've mentioned your grandmothers?
I know. It really is funny, right?
They're important.
I mean, they, for moms, absolutely. Though. And mine as well. Mm. But they loom large in almost everything you've all said about what food means to you.
Yeah. And they lived in a different time. You know, it was food you had to cook back then. And I think it's one of those things that it just was passed down through our grandmothers and through our mothers and through us. And like Amy said, it's not always the way it works. But for us, I think it was really part of our spirits and connected.
Well, I mean, my mom really taught me more about cooking than my grandmother. But my, you know, my mom's era, it's just that we all are of the generation that, you know, you grow up with, like, there's more processed food.
Yeah.
And so there's something to be that I revere more about, you know, grandma and great grandma's generations because of just, you know, what they had to cook with, they didn't use as much. My mom never really used Jell-O either. We kind of skipped that. But, you know, it was just, you know, it's still a little bit of shake and bake and things like that, you know. So it was those old generations that I think that our generation is really excited about.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, I think mom's cooking is much more a functional cooking. Like, let's cook to get you some food so we can move on with the evening. Right. While grandmother's like, I have 3 days to make this.
Well, so, that's true, too.
Right. So you can sit down and relax and spend time observing and absorbing all that she has to pass on. While with mom, it's like, all right, let's get this done.
Well, see, mine was opposite. My mom she cooked constantly and made all the food. Like, Aaron and I were sitting after I'd finished the book, and he's like, really, what did your grandma make? And I talked to him. I was like, he's like, yeah, we know all these like icons and these things that you mentioned, the bread, the pie, the this, the that. He's like, but like meals. And it was like sauerkraut hot dish. I mean,
nice.
I don't remember. That was good. But I don't remember the kinds of meals that my mom would put on. But my grandmother was very good at spinning the lore and the folk. And she was, I mean, she would also, when you go back to how do you make stuff, she would come up with things like, you know, these poppy seeds need
the
to be
story of
ground.
How, yeah.
I mean, she was just very evocative. The poppy seeds need to be ground as fine as snuff.
Ooh.
You know, and she would just like things that would stick with you, you know, like
they're good storytellers.
She was good at that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And even mentioning fine as snuff, my grandmother would say, instead of saying 2 milliliters of water, a big gill of water, which means it's enough.
Yeah.
And so you had to learn what enough was.
Or recipes that used a half an eggshell of water.
Right.
Tommy, I'm curious if Baby Lou is still alive.
She passed a couple of years ago, but she had the pleasure of knowing about the restaurant. And
okay,
knowing
that's
about
what I was curious
us,
about.
Absolutely about.
Did she ever come here?
She never wanted to travel to Minnesota, which is crazy.
It's but, cold.
I know.
Jamaica's
from Jamaica
warm.
To Minnesota.
I was curious about what it would have been like to walk into Pimento Jamaican kitchen for her.
Wow.
Have you thought of that?
Mm-hmm. I've never thought of it, and it really move something within me just now when I'm thinking about it, because I think we try to keep her spirit alive every day in the restaurant. We have paintings of her in there and
really?
All of that. Yeah. And I think her walking into Pimento, she'd have been pleased with the energy the minute you enter, because you can smell the food from the parking lot, you know, and she'd have been pleased with that. But naturally, like all grandmothers, they'd have wanted to figure out how to help you better fine tune everything. And
I
will never deny that. And it would have been an amazing experience to have had somebody who basically invented so many of the things that I'm turning into a prophet now to have experienced it. And she'd have been pleased with it, but confused based on the ingredients, confused about the sourcing.
Well, my mom's confused. She's like, really? Why do people want to come to your restaurant?
Right.
I mean, my mom's still alive and she comes in and, you know, I think she's deep down proud, but she's like, the first thing she'll say is like, that's too salty.
Right. Or she'll, my mom criticizes my food as well.
You know, yes. She'll be the first one to criticize, but comes from a place of love, I think.
When she says, why do people want to come to your restaurant? Is it because she thinks, what's so special about this food and why would people pay for it?
She cooked because she had to. It wasn't, you know, we never went out to eat when we were growing up. It's just, we didn't spend money on going out to eat. The culture's changed and shifted, obviously, but for her, it's really, she's fascinated by the fact that people are putting down their hard-earned money for other people to cook for you. And again, it comes from a genuine place of love, but I think deep inside, that's something she's always wanted to do. You know, I think if she had that, I think she was passionate about it, but she was trying to raise a family, you know, and send their kids off to college. And she was, you know, we were immigrants. And so she didn't have that luxury. And I think for her to see her daughter being able to take this dream and this passion that she probably shared too, and I'm getting a little bit emotional, but just like you, and to really make a life of it and become happy doing it, I think it's kind of fulfilled her dream too. So she criticizes because she doesn't want it to go to my head, because she always says, like, don't ever let this stuff go to your head. The first thing my dad does is he goes straight to the bathroom and says, if your bathroom's not clean, nothing is clean. So, you know, I got people looking after me.
Oh, my gosh. And now I know why you're so successful. You're from stock like that. Oh, my gosh. Never let it go to your head. That sounds like that's kind of the what you took to New York with you in some ways, Amy, when you left Park Rapids.
Oh, absolutely.
Remember who you are and what
you're
about.
Oh, remember who you are. And my dad and my mom, too, they, you know, they weren't really, like, coddly. And I always had to work for everything. And, you know, I had to prove myself, definitely. I didn't grow up with any entitlements that way.
Absolutely. And it comes through in the memoir.
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny. It's like, when I was a cook in New York and I'd been working for 7 years, you know, I would come home for Thanksgiving and my mom really didn't want me to contribute any dishes to the Thanksgiving table.
Wow.
You know, because that was her meal. Like, meals were, they belong to people, right?
Yeah.
And we had a, and now we're better, but there was a conflict there. And I think it was also because I'm so experimental in the way that I cook. And she has this repertoire of, like, really airtight meals, and they're delicious, you know, and she does them right. And she, you know, they're great and they're consistently great. And I would just come up with stuff on the fly and also cook over too high a heat and, like, you know, yeah. So it was always, there's this battle between improvisation and history with her and I. And I think that she understands now where I'm coming from, because, you know, I started, like, you know, coming up with original recipes and making a cookbook, and she kind of saw where it was going. But at first it was odd that I wasn't just, you know, sticking with, like, her stuff and or the family stuff and just recreating it.
Really great to have you guys here.
Thank you.
Thanks
Carrie.
So much.
Thank you
for a good
us.
Roundtable conversation.
Thanks, Carrie.